With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Everyone here is
bad. Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Tonight, we have cool information on a new synthetic material that helps blood clotting. And did you know our moon may be shrinking? And a report on bird poo and what it means to you. The aging solar system is older than we think. Viral tweets. More about the BP oil mess and some reports that actual science might even be going on there. Zombie DNA and a quote-unquote new study proclaiming Darwin was wrong again. Now here's a tune to get us started off.
Spawn.
first story, a new gel seals wounds fast. Synthetic material revs up blood clotting at a low cost. A new gel may provide a cheap means of stanching blood flow on the battlefield or in any other situation where there just isn't time for stitches. Estimates suggest that the gel would cost less than $10 per application, which is a fraction of the cost of other gels in use today. Researchers reported this August 23rd at the American Chemical Society's fall meeting. Now, this new blood clotting material is a hydrogel. It's a jello-like mixture of water and fibrous polymer, and in this case, an acrylamide decorated with positively charged nitrogen-containing groups. Experiments with blood plasma reveal that the gel kicks into gear a blood clotting protein known as factor 7, a key player in the cascade of events that leads to coagulation. This is said by biomedical engineer Brendan Casey of the University of Maryland in College Park. "You can just slap it on a wound," Casey said. In experiments in which Casey and colleagues made incisions in sheep, lung, and liver tissue, the hydrogel stopped the lungs from bleeding in about 2 minutes, the liver in 4 to 5 minutes. Now, the research team suspects that the polymer's positive charge and stiffness induce the clotting. Many other hydrogels used in medicine today are based on biological materials such as chitin, a structural component found in the cell walls of certain fungi, the beaks of squid, and shells of lobster and crabs. Now, while these materials have their plus sides, such as breaking down in a friendly manner inside the human body, they are more easily contaminated by viruses and other microorganisms than synthetic gels are, and can trigger an allergic response in some people. And those bio-based hydrogels cost $400 to $500 a pop, said Casey. Now, the team's approach using a synthetic polymer seems like a promising strategy, said Sasa Angelic of Ethicon, which is a Johnson & Johnson company in Somerville, New Jersey. While the gel isn't absorbable by the body, he said, it looks like it would work as well as a topical treatment. And you can read more about it on the American Chemical Society's website at www.acs.org. Did you know that our moon might be shrinking? It seems that the moon has shrunk globally in the past billion years, according to some new high-resolution pictures. The evidence comes in the form of cliffs all over the moon that have formed over the last million millennia like wrinkles on the surface of a dried-out piece of fruit. Scientists have studied 70 to 80 of these cliffs called lobate scarps since the Apollo missions in the 70s. The scarps are generally tens of kilometers long and less than 100 meters high. Researchers had already hypothesized that the scarps were due to shrinkage, but the Apollo images showed only the moon's equatorial region. Scientists weren't sure whether the scarps span the entire surface of the moon. But now, images in the August 20th issue of Science from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, this is NASA's unmanned moon satellite, reveal 14 new scarps from spots all over the moon. It's the first definitive evidence that the scarps occur globally. This is the best observational evidence so far that the lunar cooling and contraction has persisted over the last billion years, says planetary scientist Sean Solomon of the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington, D.C. Lobate scarps are formed when a planet or moon cools and contracts inside. The loss of volume squeezes portions of the outer crust together. Eventually, the crust breaks and some of it is pushed up, creating long cliffs that look like wrinkles. The process is a little like what happens when an apple has gone past its prime, says Thomas Waters, a planetary scientist at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, who led the study. As the apple dries out, it loses volume, so the skin gets wrinkly. Waters and his team looked at the pattern of craters over and underneath the newly observed scarps to determine their ages. Now, most were untouched by the larger craters produced by giant impacts early in the moon's history, and the scarps tended to cut across younger, smaller craters produced by objects that pelted the surface more recently. The evidence points to some recent shrinkage of perhaps 100 meters or so in radius, says Waters. Now, in lunar terms, recent, quote-unquote, means the past billion years. So there's a general impression that the moon is geologically dead, that anything of geological importance happened billions and billions of years ago, Waters said. The scarp's very young appearance suggests that the shrinking of the moon could have happened very recently and, in fact, could still be going on. But moon gazers have nothing to fear. The change isn't noticeable. Just 100 meters over a billion years isn't much, Waters said. By comparison, the scarps on Mercury are over a kilometer high and some span 1,000 kilometers, he said, suggesting shrinkage of up to a kilometer. Now, Waters says the small shrinkage adds support to this idea that the moon started out somewhat cool and partially molten and shrank less than 1 kilometer over its entire lifetime. But other scientists, such as retired lunar and planetary scientist Alan Binder of the Lunar Research Institute in Tucson, thinks the moon was completely molten at its birth and may have shrunk as much as 5 kilometers in its life. I'm glad to see this, even though I don't think it's a great revelation, Binder says. Now, he is among those who first described the scarps 30 years ago and hypothesized about their implications. Every new scarp is better, but it hasn't changed the picture at all. It's just adding a little more data. Next, the scientists will use the LRO to image the entire moon's surface and find the total number and pattern of its scarps. Scientists can then better infer how the cliffs were formed and how much the moon has actually shrunk. And by comparing current images with those taken 30 to 40 years ago, they'll be able to see if the scarps have changed since then. Images can be found of this phenomena in the August 20th issue of Science or at NASA.gov. You might want to hurry up and see it now before it's gone. In our next story, tracking bird flu one poop at a time. Mice can sniff out duck droppings laced with virus. Ducks and goose droppings, the bane of golfers and park visitors, may help scientists track the spread of bird flu with olfactory assistance from properly trained animals. Scientists have trained mice to identify the poop of ducks infected with avian influenza. Chemical ecologist Bruce Kimball reported this August 24th at the American Chemical Society's fall meeting, a busy place to be this month. If mice can pick up the scent, it should also be possible to train dogs to track the flu trail, said Kimball. He is at the National Wildlife Research Center at Fort Collins, Colorado, and at the Monell Chemical Sciences Center in Philadelphia. I would like to joke that we're going to send people out with mice on leashes, he said, but my vision is we could train dogs in much the same way. Mice trained on the scent of poop from infected birds correctly chose infected poop over uninfected poop 90% of the time, Kimball reported. When the mice were presented with new droppings not used in the training sessions, the rodents identified the flu-laced feces 77% of the time. Many diseases, such as diabetes and some cancers, are known to alter the chemical profile of an infected individual's breath. So the presence of a poop profile also seems reasonable, Kimball says. Now, he and his colleagues suspect that the mice are tuning in to the compounds produced by the duck's immune systems in response to the flu. Evidence suggests that some duck species excrete more flu virus than other birds, making the water birds prime disease spreaders via migratory travels or, more likely, when ducks are bought and sold in poultry markets. Hundreds of millions of ducks, chickens, turkeys, and geese died of flu or were killed to prevent the spread of H5N1 virus that emerged in Hong Kong in the late 1990s. By 2006, more than 200 people had been picked up this bug, and estimates suggest that the economic impact of the disease was more than $10 billion. Now, if dogs can be trained to sniff out infected birds, it could streamline efforts to control an outbreak. Based on my experience, if a mouse can be trained for a scent chore, so can a dog, said Gary Settles, director of the Gas Dynamics Laboratory at Pennsylvania State University at University Park. Now, their olfactory apparatus is very similar, just of a different size, says Settles, who was not involved in the research, but he's an expert. I know of no chemical trace detection chore that mice can do, but dogs cannot. The scientists are still trying to figure out the precise chemical compounds that make the mice latch onto, Kimball says. The research team irradiated the duck's droppings to make sure the flu wasn't infectious. Now, that's a good thing. A precaution that may have affected the poop smell profile, he said. Again, you can find out more of the poopy particulars from the American Chemical Society at www.acs.org. System might be older than originally estimated. The solar system may be almost 2 million years older than previously thought, according to a new study. Data from a newly studied meteorite recovered from the Saharan Desert show that the solar system formed 4,568.2 million years ago, which is 0.3 million to 1.9 million years earlier than other estimates. The results were published online August 22nd in Nature Geoscience. All the interesting things we want to understand about the chemistry of our solar system happen within the first 5 to 10 million years, says study co-author Meenakshi Wadhwa, a cosmochemist from University State University in Tempe. When you push it back by 2 million years, that's a substantial proportion of that 5 to 10 million years. The meteorite contains millimeter and centimeter sized bits of calcium and aluminum rich substances, some of the oldest material ever found in primordial rocks. These pockets in the rock, called inclusions, are believed to be among the first solids that condensed from gas at the beginning of the solar system's formation. Along with other materials in the pre-solar cloud, the inclusions snowballed into larger objects, eventually forming asteroids and planets. Study co-author Audrey Bouvier of Arizona State measured the ratios of variance of lead atoms produced by radioactive decay of uranium present when the inclusions formed. Since uranium decays at a known rate, current amounts of lead forms or isotopes allow scientists to calculate how long ago the space dust formed. Now, two meteorites previously analyzed for their lead isotope ratio suggested the first solar system solids formed 4,567.1 million to 4,567.6 million years ago. But these ages were inconsistent with other radioactive clocks, quote-unquote, in the same rocks, such as one based on the decay of an aluminum isotope to magnesium. The uranium-lead decay age is consistent with other clocks in the new meteorite. The rock probably went through less heating and bombardment when it was part of an asteroid than the previously studied meteorites did, the authors say, so it experienced less chemical change. The softball-sized meteorite was found in Morocco in 2004 and weighs a little over 3 pounds. It's like a crime scene investigation 4.5 billion years after the scene has vacated, says astrophysicist Alan Boss of the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington, D.C. We're coming toward a more cohesive picture of how things happened. Now, these results can be found in the August 22 issue of Nature Geoscience. In technology news, going viral takes a posse, not an army. Dedicated followers spread the word online. When it comes to going viral online, it's not how many people you know, but who they are, a new study suggests. An analysis of the social networking tool Twitter concludes that having a lot of followers isn't as important to internet exposure as having discriminating followers to pass the message on. The results suggest that those trying to communicate through social networking, be they politicians, advertising executives, or philanthropic organizations, shouldn't focus their efforts on targeting the masses. Target the influential, and the masses will come. It's not only the numbers, the quantity of your audience, but also the quality of your audience, says study co-author Wojciech Goluba, and he is from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. The research suggests that in some regards, the online world isn't that different from real life. If somebody you know recommends a book, whether or not you actually read it depends on a lot of factors, including your reading habits and your opinion of that person's opinion. To determine who has influence in the online world, Goluba and Daniel Romero of Cornell University and their colleagues looked at tweets, the 140-character messages posted on the Twitter social network that contain links to web pages. That allowed the scientists to see how many recipients of the tweet took action by retweeting it and passing it on, and how many times who received it actually clicked on the link. To get a better measure of influence, the research team created an algorithm that doesn't just incorporate the tweeter's number of followers, but also whether those followers are passive and listless or dedicated and engaged. The team tested the algorithm on 22 million link-containing tweets sent during a 300-hour period in September of 2009. The algorithm was a far better predictor of whether someone clicked through to a link than other measures such as sheer number of followers or a number of retweets. The researchers reported this in a study posted online August 6 on AR. Well, I'll give that to you later. It's a really long web address. The algorithm yielded both surprises and well does. Google News and The Onion both were influential tweeters with lots of followers who also passed their tweets along to more people who in turn retweeted them yet again. So tweeting and retweeting is going on here. But Twitter feeds of media monsters like NPR Politics, E! Online, and Martha Stewart, believe it or not, ranked 41st, 42nd, and 43rd, respectively, in number of followers, and were outranked by hundreds of other tweeters in terms of influence. For example, Rob Miller, a congressional candidate from South Carolina, ranked 147,803rd in a number of followers, but 145th in terms of overall influence. The algorithm may find use in determining influence for a specific question or time frame, says Romero. For instance, during an election cycle, one could examine all the tweets related to politics and see which candidate is best at spreading the word. Measuring influence by more than just audience size is a more important step, says information scientist Jim Jansen of Pennsylvania State University in University Park. But the true measure of influence is his action, he says, which researchers are just starting to figure out how to assess this. Get me to buy something or get me to go to the polls, get me to send money to Haiti or go to a demonstration, he says, and that's influence. So, this online study was posted August 6th on arx15.org or ar16.org. 16 is in Roman numerals. Okay, there you go. Finally, I kicked that out. On to the next story. Junk DNA can rise from the dead and haunt you. Scientists have found that junk DNA can come back to life and cause disease. As it turns out, a region of the genome that is hundreds of thousands of years old, mind you, can bring on trouble. Soon after the zombie gene wakes up, people can no longer smile and their upper body muscles begin to waste away. Those victims suffer from facioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy, also known as FSHD, one of the more common forms of the genetic disease. 1 in 20,000 people suffer from FSHD, which makes it different than other diseases like diabetes, in that inheriting the gene means that the person will one day get the genetic disease. While scientists knew genetics was to blame, they didn't exactly know why and how it caused disease, but now they know zombies are to blame. The researchers published their results in Science. There's a certain rhythm to this madness. To cause disease, the gene needs to be repeated a number of times and has to have the right sequence. The trouble gene is found on chromosome 4, which is a region scientists have eyed for decades. If the zombie gene is repeated more than 10 times, the person will not develop FSHD. Researchers believe the surplus copies change the structure of the chromosome so that the zombie gene can't attack. Otherwise, the gene, DUX4, is allowed to be made and becomes toxic to the muscle cells. This finding fundamentally changes how geneticists think about simple genetic diseases. It's clear that even though FSHD was thought to be a simple disease because having the gene meant the person would definitely get the disease, it's actually much more complex than that. In the future, researchers could knock out this dead gene and develop new treatments. Scientists believe they will discover that other diseases will have similar causes. Geneticist Dr. Francis Collins told this to the New York Times. The first law of the genome is that anything that can go wrong will. Check this out in the latest issue of Science or on smartplanet.com. And on a side note, I say this is a good thing. We continually test and retest things in science because new information is always being found. Gotta love it. And thank you to Marcus Leader for sending me this story.
Touch faith.
Now here's a story on the BP mess. The deep sea oil plume goes missing. Controversy arises over whether bacteria have completely gobbled it up. In May, researchers began reporting that the massive jets of crude emanating from BP's damaged Deepwater Horizon well were creating deep, diffuse plumes of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Since then, chemical oceanographers have been probing the plumes for indirect clues about how quickly native bacteria might be gobbling up the oil. Microbial ecologist Terry Hazen of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California now thinks he has a surprising answer, very quickly. He's part of a broad team of scientists from two Department of Energy national labs and two universities that's been collecting the plume samples continually over months. In a paper posted online August 24th in Science, the team reports data from late May to early June showing that those deep sea plumes entice a hitherto unknown cold water adapted bacterium to rapidly chow down on the oil. Indeed, Hazen says, those bugs have been so voracious that for one plume of oil his team has been following, quote, within the last 3 weeks we no longer detect a plume at all, unquote. It went away approximately 2 weeks after the well was capped on July 15th, he observes. Its oil is completely undetectable. Also, the unusual population of oil-digesting bacteria that had inhabited that plume and would ordinarily be expected to stay with it as it moved remained behind in a vestigial microbial cloud. Doesn't that suggest biodegradation, he asks? Speaking of deep-sea plumes, I've heard rumors they might have gone missing, notes David Valentine, a microbial geochemist at the University of California at Santa Barbara, but currents might have moved them into hiding. It might be nice to think that the oil has been removed, he says, but if it sounds too good to be true, he cautions, it probably is, and yes, this sounds too good to be true. Only 1 week earlier, scientists from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts reported evidence in Science that native microbes were feasting, albeit slowly, on a plume the researchers were mapping. Their measurements, made more than a month before the BP well was capped, did not include any microbe counts or species identifications, Hazen says, both of which his team included. I was amazed, Hazen said, at how similar the Woods Hole data were to ours in terms of the definition of the plume, its estimated flow rate, size, path, and very low oil concentrations. Where the data diverge is over the oil's estimated degradation rates. In the field and in the lab tanks where plume microbes were housed with crude oil, petroleum appears to have a half-life of just 1.2 to 6.1 days, the latest study finds. In essence, Hazen explains every 2 to 6 days, the volume of the surviving oil fell by half. The bacteria responsible mostly belonged to a newly identified species that may have constituted 90% of bacteria in the plume versus only some 5% of those outside of it. The microbes didn't deplete the water's oxygen stores quickly, as might have been expected. Evidence of their prodigious activity was measured in a depression of nitrates in the water, Hazen says, and a continuous loss of straight-chain oil hydrocarbons known as alkanes, first the shorter ones and then the longer hydrocarbons. Among the bugs was a flock of waste from the petroleum dining. Now, Hazen's interpretations has its skeptics. Most of the science associated with this spill has been oversimplified, says John Kessler, a chemical oceanographer at Texas A&M University in College Station. Now, in good faith effort to make sense of what's going on, many researchers look to offer interpretations based on too few data, he charges. For instance, he says, what Hazen was measuring was a component of the entire hydrocarbon matrix, which is a complex mix of literally thousands of different molecules. Although the few molecules described in the new paper in Science may well have degraded within weeks, Kessler says, there are others which have much longer half-lives in the order of years and sometimes even decades. Moreover, he points out, many of the tools traditionally used to gauge biodegradation don't work well in the field. Few teams have lately begun transitioning the use of more sensitive probes, he says, and the data from those more sensitive tools are fueling his skepticism of Hazen's report that microbes may have been erasing deep sea plumes. And this is as recently as August 22nd, Kessler says. I spoke to some of those researchers out there in the Gulf, and they told me they were still seeing plumes. Again, you can see this in the recent copy of Online Science. controversy seems to be in the air in the scientific community, and the natives are restless in all the genres. Here's a new study. Darwin may have been wrong. A new study published in Biology Letters argues that Charles Darwin's theory of evolution may have been wrong. While Darwin argued that competition was the key force driving evolution, a research team from the University of Bristol argues that, quote-unquote, living space is in fact the primary driver. Michael Benton, a co-author of the study, said his team concluded that, quote, competition did not play a big role in the overall pattern of evolution, unquote. The new study proposes that really big evolutionary changes happen when animals move into empty areas of living space not occupied by other animals. For example, when birds evolved the ability to fly, that opened up a vast range of new possibilities not available to other animals. Suddenly, the skies were quite literally the limit, triggering a new evolutionary burst. Slate describes how PhD student Sarda Sene conducted her research. Using fossils to study evolutionary patterns over hundreds of millions of years of history, Sene and team found that biodiversity, at least among the land animals that they decided to focus on, matched the availability of living space through time. Living space refers to the particular requirements of individual organisms to thrive and reproduce. It can include several components, but primarily describes the availability of food and favorable habitat. Throughout geological time, patterns of global diversity of tetrapod families show 97% correlation with ecological modes. Sene wrote this in Biology Letters article co-authored also by Michael Benton and Paul Ferry. Not all have accepted this team's conclusions, though. According to BBC News, Yale University evolutionary biologist Stephen Stearns said that the interpretation was, quote-unquote, problematic. What is the impetus to occupy new portions of ecological space if not to avoid competition within the species in the space already occupied? Stearns asked. So what do you think of their theory? Is it bogus or does it have legs? You can go give your two cents at the backtalk section of this article found on the Huffington Post. I will be on there too, ragging on how I feel this so-called interpretations are completely asinine. But hey, that's just me and most of the scientific community. Wow, this reminds me of the 2009 New Scientist, which published the issue on the cover, was a huge declaration. Darwin was wrong. It was a big tree in the background. And of course, they got pummeled by the scientific community. And the fallout is that the creationists and ID proponents keep posting this thing on blogs far and wide. I know I've seen it just like 100 times. All I can say is it is an epic fail for Roger Highfield with that lovely piece of journalism, and I think this is going to get the same treatment. Anyway, get on over to the Huff and let them know what you think of the latest Darwin hater wine-offs, and they also have a link to the actual study itself that was published in Biology Letters. Okay, I have a special premiere pass to see the M. Night Shyamalan new release called Devil. Yeah, I know I've had this report on his past cinematic disasters ready for public consumption, but I'm going to beg off until I get to see if this filmmaker can redeem himself after the atrocious train wreck that was Airbender, which of course followed the several other competing train wrecks that preceded that one. Now, what the heck is wrong with me that I'm holding out hope that this one will be the one to save his ass from being one of the headstones in the movie fail cemetery? I don't know. I must always root for the underdog or something, but I really want to see him do a dazzler that will knock my socks off. I'll let you know after I see the flick. I hope, you know, it doesn't piss me off, as again, I'm starting to feel like the Charlie Brown every time Lucy promises to hold that football and then pulls it away at the last minute. His movies are becoming a cinema critic's carnivorous smorgasbord at this point. Well, this has been Savage Science, and next week, a special look inside the life of an extraordinary girl that has made a film about her life called My Story of C. Please tune in and share this with people you know. She is nothing short of incredible. I would like to thank Nick Palico for the gorgeous show graphics and Dennis Baum and Hawk Productions for the awesome intro music. Until next time, keep your powder and your pants dry and happy trails. Thank you.
Yeah, here come the roosters.